This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this Monday, December 16th, and we have several subjects to talk about. Year-end retirement and benefit planning, 2014 planning, mid-career and new employee planning. I certainly couldn't do this by myself, so we're going to be joined with Bob Braunstein, federal benefits expert, retired Fed, fellow seminar presenter. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Bob. How are you doing?
Well, better now that I know you're on the other end of the line.
Yes, and I'm in much better weather than you are, too, down here in Florida.
Yes. Well, I'm going to catch the noon shuttle to wherever you are.
Well, that's true. I'll be waiting. I'll pick you up at the airport.
Okay. See you at 3. All righty, Bob. This is a healthy dose of topics to do in the time allotted, but we can touch on each. So we're talking about the end of 2013. We have some room left for year-end retirement and benefit planning. What to do between now and the end of December? What do we do to maximize benefits? Is there something we can do this late in the year to maximize the benefits if we're soon to retire, say, at the end of the month or the beginning part of next year?
Well, hopefully, you know, if you've really been thinking about it, one of the primary things that federal employees try to do is get a large chunk of change when they leave via their annual leave lump sum benefits. The retirement rules allow you to carry over your annual leave ceiling from the prior year, and as long as you retire on or before the day the leave year ends, this year that's not actually until January 12th, then when you actually retire, you'll get paid for all of your annual leave, the ceiling plus any use or lose that you haven't used, in a lump sum. And then, of course, you're the tax guy. I mean, figure it out. You get paid for this. It takes about 4 weeks to hit your checking account, which won't be until the next tax year. So if you're truly retired, then the tax liability on that rather large amount of money is going to be significantly less, assuming your bracket is dropped. So that's a primary strategy, not to mention the fact that, you know, there's a pay raise this year for the first time in several years. It's not a big one, but it's a percentage. And most of that annual leave would be paid out to an individual at the higher rate, even though they technically might not even be there at the date the raise becomes effective. Annual leave is paid as if used. So the formula for paying it would be, how long would it take me into the next calendar year, and how much of that is beyond the date of the pay raise? And all of that's paid at the higher rate, whether you're there to get it or not.
Okay.
Kind of an interesting way to go.
All righty. I got a little bit of a planning tip with regards to the accumulated leave, the voluntary contribution, and the folks covered under CSRS or CSRS offset need to listen to this. FERS don't. The voluntary contribution can be funded with up to 10% of one's federal lifetime earnings. Most people don't have that kind of money, but if they do have accumulated leave, one tactic might be to borrow the net amount that they expect to get in their accumulated leave check. What I mean by net, if they have X number of hours multiplied by their hourly rate, that would be the total amount to be paid. It's going to be 100% taxable, so you have to boil out the taxes. So let's say that that's $10,000. I'm just using a round number. And let's say the taxes, all things considered on that, might be 30%. There'd be $7,000 net payment. Go out and borrow $7,000. Put it in the voluntary contribution. Now, you're not going to have a loan very long because you're going to receive the accumulated leave check in the next year. You'll get your $7,000 check, pay the loan back, voila, you put money into the voluntary contribution program without digging into your checking account should there not be enough in there to dig into. Does that make sense?
Oh, it does. Absolutely. And I think most financial organizations would probably give you a pretty decent rate on a short-term loan. typically only takes about 4 weeks to get the lump sum annual leave check once you leave federal service. So that's an excellent strategy. Not to mention the fact, and you may or may not know this, Bob, but you technically could continue to fund voluntary contributions even beyond the date you retire. There's a small section of the retirement application as regards voluntary contributions. And if you request additional information about this from OPM, then technically you have, I guess, what you'd call through their period of adjudication to continue to contribute to voluntary contributions. I mean, it typically takes OPM 3 to 4 months to adjudicate an agency's paperwork with respect to an individual retirement, and they're sending you slightly smaller checks as the retiree until they finally do this. During that whole period, you could actually find additional money somewhere else to continue to fund your voluntary contribution amount. And as you say, it's all after-tax dollars, so it can come from checking account money. You could sell a car. You could use some of the proceeds of that. You know, whatever it is. It's unlike TSP, which has to come out of biweekly payroll withholding and is either pre-tax or could go to the Roth side of your account. This could come from anywhere, and you have extra time to do it.
Okay, great point. Now let's put everybody back in the pool. FIR, CSRS, whatever. Year-end tax planning and hope for opportunities in the subsequent year. So if one retires at the end of the year, early part of January, the final salary check is certainly going to be received in the new year, and in our example here, 2014. That can be used to front load the thrift. Now, this is not going to be a huge amount unless you make a huge amount, but you could regulate it by you're going to have your normal withholdings, whether it's Social Security and or Medicare. But you might want to try to delete the state and federal income tax, because if it's going to go into the TSP, you're not going to pay taxes on it, so you might as well get as much money as you can in there. The other mandatory withholdings would, of course, be health insurance and the like. The accumulated leave check that we just talked about in another reference cannot be used to fund the thrift, but the final salary check can. Just a comment for looking at probably for more ways to save money in the coming calendar year than the current year.
Well, it's an interesting question, an interesting point. That makes perfect sense. One of the strategies that you've mentioned in an article in the past, and one that I continue to tout as a possible option if people want to do it, is this whole concept, and I don't want to jump the gun here, but as long as we're talking about it, let's talk about TSP front loading. What if somebody, was thinking, well, I've already used up my use or lose annual leave. I've got my 240 or whatever my leave ceiling is. How about if I stick around a little bit longer? I have to do that if I want to continue to contribute to TSP, and maybe spend 6 months getting as much into the thrift savings plan as I can. You know, I can do that as long as I'm working, and technically I'd still be earning annual leave. And if I left midway through the year and didn't use any of my annual leave, I'd have my 240 plus another 104 hours on top of that, not to mention the fact that I might have a pretty significant tax break on next year's income tax if I front load TSP.
And you're absolutely right. And the other thing we talk about in class is if you're going to be the first quarter or the second quarter, you can front load the thrift. And for most people, it's hard to fully fund the thrift. Or if they do, they usually spread it out over 26 pay periods. Well, if they go out at the end of March, end of June, they're not going to have 26 pay periods. And exactly like you say, you could take a significant amount of your compensation and put it in there. But sometimes people say, well, I can't do that because I'm going to have so much withholding. Now, some withholding, you're just not going to be able to stop. FICA, Medicare, health insurance, and other things. Maybe a flexible spending account. But one of the larger numbers on the withholding in anybody's paycheck is the federal and state withholding. Well, if you're going to have a goodly portion, if not all of your salary going into the thrift, it's not too good to have withholding that you're just going to get back in a refund. So change your withholding, in other words, increase your number of exemptions, and try to get that down to zero. It flows up, frees up cash flow. And if you're trying to put all this type of money away too, you might have a little trouble with your bills. So yeah. This would help as well.
let me ask a question on that, Bob. You know, I get this question from people all the time, and they say, well, you know, is it right for me to claim more exemptions or allowances or whatever you call those things? I mean, how many can I actually claim? Doesn't the IRS get mad at you if you do that? And do you have the answer to that one?
Well, for the longest time, it was 13. And I'm not saying that 13 is the limit, but we've experimented recently with a number of people and gone in with 20. And that about kills it.
Wow.
Yeah.
So in other words, you don't need any specific permission, and you don't need any particular life circumstances to go ahead and claim all of these extra allowances, which in effect increases your net pay, which in effect gives you more money to pump into the thrift. You can just do that.
You can do it, but again, heed my words. For the longest time, it was 13, and if you wanted to go over 13, you had to explain it to your employer. Not that it was any of their business, but they supposedly passed it along to the IRS. And you could see the problems with that. By the time the one hand gives it to the other hand, it gives it to the third hand, the people could be retired and moved. So,
right.
So they seem to have loosened up.
Well, it's good to know, because I've been telling folks that, and, you know, the light bulbs do come on. You know, one of the things they have to always realize is that the only way you can contribute directly to TSP is as an employee, and the only way you can contribute is through your paycheck. So the more money you can put in there that's discretionary by claiming more allowances or exemptions, the better position you are in to do that front-loading. Now, the front-loading of TSP, if one is in FERS, that's going to have a certain compromising effect on that match, isn't it?
Well, that's true. So they want to hit whatever they're going to hit on their last paycheck.
Right.
If they hit it before, then they lose the match for that period of time.
Got it. Good. Very, very interesting stuff. I mean, those are the typical questions that I get from folks. There are other reasons. You know, one of the unique things about FERS this year, there was a phase-in of a law that happened a few years ago, the Defense Authorization Bill of 2010, that finally, after all of these years, allowed FERS retirees to add accumulated unused sick leave to their annuity benefit for additional annuity value once they were qualified to retire. The phase-in period goes through the end of this year, where if somebody was retiring, say, for example, December 31st, they would still only be allowed to add half of their accumulated sick leave. Now, if you're retiring after the 31st of December, say into January, then you can add all of your sick leave. But, of course, the problem is, too, if you want that lump sum annual leave payment, you have to retire on or before the leave year ends, which is January 12th. But interestingly enough, and I saw this in an article, and I think it really depends on, you know, what your income is, if you believe that compensation from your federal agency for the first week and a half in January is going to be equal to or perhaps even greater than your FERS annuity for January, then you can opt to retire on January 12th. And you basically will get credit for all of your sick leave. You'll get your lump sum annual leave payment. You'll get your first check from OPM on March 1st, paying you for February. But your January compensation, for all intents and purposes, is somewhat of a wash, or might even be better at your active pay than for a full month's annuity, because typically FERS annuities are not as high as CSRS annuities. So this is a way to maximize a lot of things. You get annual leave. You get full credit for your sick leave, and you get compensation that's roughly equivalent or, again, perhaps even higher than it would be if it were coming from OPM, if you stay with your agency through the 12th of January.
Okay, and that leave year end for this year is January what, next year?
It's the 12th. Last year, you know, and it happens every 10 years, last year it actually ended on the 31st of December, so you pretty much had to be gone by then. But then that only happens once every 10 years, and then immediately the next year after that, it's pretty late in January, the 12th this year. I think it'll be like the 10th or the 9th of the following year, and it'll slowly ratchet its way back down to the December 31st date. I think about every 10 years it gets back to December 31st. But this year you have a lot more room. Remember, FERS annuities, so for 30 years, the general population is usually getting about 30% of high three average salary. it could very well be that 12 days of compensation, or being as an active federal employee for 12 days, you wouldn't get paid for all 12 because your work schedule would be different, but that payment up to that point in time at your current federal salary could be equal to or perhaps even greater than your annuity.
Wow. All this extra money, Bob. All righty. I bet somebody has a question, and they can call in and ask it, and we'll welcome it. 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. Today is Monday, December 16th. It's 10:21 Eastern Time. We go off at about 10:58 Eastern Time. So if you're listening to the show, which is rebroadcast, don't call us. Call us next week. We'll be back next week. Kind of a year-end wrap-up show. All righty, Bob. Let's go on into marching on into 2014. We've got a whole year to plan, New Year's resolutions. Yeah, I'm going to do this differently. I'm going to do that differently. But let's take a look at somebody maybe retiring in 2014 or 15, and then we'll take a look at a mid-career person or a beginning career person. So the pre-retiree, what should they be looking at to start gathering to make their transition smooth?
You're talking mid-career.
Pre-retirement. They're going to retire in 2014 sometime, or maybe early 2015. And then we'll look at the mid-career person. Next.
Again, I think at this point in time, if I were planning to retire at the end of the year, one of the things I'd be looking at is, you know, doing whatever I can to maximize my annual leave benefit. In other words, I've got things that I've got to be doing, but by the same token, if I'm judicious about the manner in which I use it, if I'm a bit on the stingy side, if I'm working an alternative work schedule and have every other Friday off, and some people have that opportunity, then I would use as little annual leave as possible. I mean, during your career, it's the people who wind up with large sick leave balances are frequently, through their career, using annual leave instead of sick leave to get that balance up. That's something you really don't want to do during this last year because you have this lump sum annual leave payment coming to you. So you definitely want to save that. Use the sick leave for what it's intended to do. You want to, particularly if you're in FERS, and I would say this is even true of CSRS, do what you can to continue to contribute to TSP. Now, max it out, if at all possible, using the strategies that we just talked about, increasing your allowances, positioning yourself to have as much money as you can in that nest egg, because if you're in FERS, it's probably the most significant component to a FERS three-legged stool. And if you're in CSRS, it could be the difference between living large and living larger. I mean, you don't get the match, but you can now contribute up to the IRS elected deferral limit of $17,500 and another catch-up contribution of $5,500 if you're 50 or will be 50 in the year that you retire for those who are leaving early. So it's a matter of maximizing those benefits and then planning your date of departure so that you can mitigate to the extent possible the taxability of those benefits.
Righty, with the pre-retiree, that's our focus right now, mid-career in a second. I get questions in class, gee, I never had a Roth IRA. I have a very small one. What do you think about the Roth TSP, they say? And it was explained once, actually, by the director of the thrift, Greg Long. Now, he wasn't saying you should do or shouldn't do. He doesn't do that. But he called this the barbell effect. The attractiveness of the Roth TSP, Roth IRA as well, on the barbell side, one side being lower than the middle section, would be the beginning career. Well, we're not talking about the beginning career. So follow the barbell up. You got mid-career, it levels out, and then it slopes back down. So somebody at pre-retirement would really have to scratch their head to say, I want to do this, because their income has never been as high. Their tax bracket most likely has never been as high. And in order to get money into a Roth TSP, they're not going to get the tax deduction. Now, the earning power is going to be the same depending on whether they invest it in whichever fund it is, whether it's in the traditional or whether it's in the Roth TSP. The earning power isn't going to, but the difference is you're going to have to write a check to Uncle Sam to do this because there's no tax break to do this. So if you want to put in, like you say, the max, it's going to be at least that amount plus the tax on that. And that's kind of that's hard to make economic sense, I think, at the later stages of one's career. Another story.
Let me ask a question about that, because I get this a lot, and I've heard the radio shows, and I think I generally know. But, I mean, if somebody was going to be contributing to thrift on an after-tax basis, to the Roth side of the account, like you say, it takes, if you're putting $1,000 in and you're in a 25% tax bracket, then it takes $1,250 to get that $1,000 in, whereupon it will perform at the same rate as any other $1,000, but you got to pay that other money up front. When you're doing that, is there a rule of thumb with respect to how many years you need to sort of recoup that the taxes that you're paying with respect to the performance of the fund? I mean, how long a time do you need to sort of break even, so to speak, and do as well?
I'd say 13 to 15 years. And,
wow.
And somebody would say, depending on the investment, well, sure, but that's going to be a given that you're going to put it in some investment. So the money inside of that investment is going to earn the same amount, whether it's in a traditional or a Roth, the profile of the investment. Now, when it comes back out, that's the huge difference. And the huge difference, of course, is the money up front. But like you say, Bob, if you want to put in 17.5 and you're in a 25% tax bracket, and for those of you all with state tax brackets, again, we're talking pre-retirement, so income is again, never been higher. You could be a 30%. So 30% of 17.5 is $5,100. And if you do the catch up, it could be $7,500.
Sure.
Ouch.
Yeah, and I've also heard too, Bob, and you please give me a sanity check on this, that it's probably not the greatest thing to do if, number one, your time's limited, which is what we're talking about now for getting the money in there in that manner, but if you believe that your income is going to be, you know, lower as a retiree, I mean, I've heard that it probably isn't the greatest strategy to go to the Roth side of your account.
I would say more so with a FERS retiree because they can manage the income, and their annuity's coming. Social
right.
Security is a question as to when you access it. And the thrift is definitely a variable up to 70.5, and even at 70.5, the amount is extremely small that comes out. So they have the opportunity then to manage how this operates, whereas with a CSRS individual, there's one large annuity, and there isn't any, I won't say there isn't, there generally isn't Social Security, but not in all cases. They got it a little bit tougher, I think, only because they make more income in retirement. So they're going to be probably somewhat in the same bracket.
Mm-hmm.
But the FERS has, that's the unique opportunity. I call it the triple decker sandwich. Tax-wise, it's the annuity, it's Social Security, and it's the TSP. But the supplement can be in there, too, which kind of parallels Social Security, but it's not called Social Security. So then, but they can manage that. That's what's nice. Did that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Absolutely. You know, you mentioned the supplement. One of the questions that I typically get in many of my retirement seminars is, you know, if I take that supplement, if I'm qualified for that, is that going to have any impact on my Social Security when I finally get to the age where I'm eligible for that? And the answer is no. I mean, briefly, the FERS annuity supplement is a bridge for FERS retirees who are retiring in one manner. You have to be at your minimum retirement age, which again is dictated by when you were born, but it's usually somewhere between the age of 56 and 57, and you need 30 years of FERS service, or possibly 60 or 61 years of age, not being eligible for Social Security, with at least 20 years of service. Then OPM basically pays the equivalent of what a Social Security benefit would be for that period of time that you were in FERS against a projected age 62 benefit. It's what people don't realize is that it isn't really being paid by Social Security. It's extra money that the Office of Personnel Management rolls into your retirement check based on a formula and based on an extrapolation of a Social Security amount that you can't get yet. So that's that's something that's definitely worth your while. It's income tested, like early Social Security, but it absolutely has no impact whatsoever on what your Social Security benefit's going to be. It's not going to diminish it or reduce it. And if you get 100% of it because you're fully retired, it has no effect on Social Security.
Okay, great. Now, we've been focusing in on income, taxes, and investing, but what things should some near-term pre-retiree be looking at as far as paperwork? Should they start early to make sure all their service years are accounted for, especially if they've had some time at the post office years ago or the reserves or something like that? Is it best to check on this sooner rather than later?
Sooner, I would say. Most employees, agencies, will give them, I guess what I would call the agency official estimate of their retirement benefit about a year out. And that particular document is great. It's generated by software that agencies use that incorporates all the rules associated with what counts and what doesn't. But most importantly, it lists on one of the pages, there are several critical pages in there, and one of them is your service history. And when you look at your service history, it should list the start date and the end date of every period of federal service you have. If you see anything on that estimate that doesn't look, you know, absolutely the way you know it to be, in other words, if there's a period of, like you say, summer work for the Postal Service that you did many, many years ago, or just a period of time from another agency, if that summary doesn't look right, it's being put together, this whole estimate is being put together by specialists who are using as a primary source document your official personnel files, official personnel folders. And sometimes, you know, particularly when those folders were paperborne, things got lost, or when you went from one agency to another, sometimes paperwork didn't transfer. And if you had an earlier period of service and didn't come back for years, it's likely that that particular period of service was in a retired OPF that might even be in the Office of Personnel Management, Boyers, Pennsylvania office.
Bob, I believe we got a call. I don't mean to cut you off, but I think they've been there a long time. They just celebrated their next birthday. Good morning.
Good morning. I am a FERS employee. I'm a GS-14. I'm retiring January 11th, and I recently changed my exemptions in federal and state taxes from two exemptions in the federal and one exemption in the state exemptions, thinking that was a wise strategy going into retirement, so that would continue through OPM into my retirement pension.
Well, it won't. If you change your withholding exemption level while in service, that's fine. When you retire, you'll receive a fair amount of paperwork, one of which, you may remember this, IRS Form W-4. I don't know if you remember it, first job you ever got, and said, here, fill this out and claim the proper number of exemptions. And, you know, back then we didn't know what an exemption meant. Now we do. But you'll have to elect a new exemption level that has nothing to do with the prior. Let's say that you don't fill out that paperwork, just for to take it to its illogical conclusion. OPM still assumes that you want withholding, which is nice in a sense for those that would be unaware of that, but they assume that you really wanted three, but you just didn't do the form, and they further assume that you're married, even if you're not.
So that means that they take out more taxes or take out less taxes?
Take out less. It's interesting you say that, because it baffles most people's understanding of withholding. The more exemptions you claim, the less tax you have. Remember, an exemption is an exemption from paying more withholding tax. So the fewer you pay, the less, the more tax you're going to have withheld. So in other words, like you did, when you switch down, your net bring home check will go down. Why? Because they're taking out more taxes.
So So that's good if your income's high, but if your income's lower in retirement, then you really want a higher exemption. So I did the wrong thing.
Well, I'm not so sure. Don't be hard on yourself, because what you have, because you're a FERS individual, I use this expression, the triple-decker sandwich. You have your FERS annuity that's coming. I won't say whether you like it or not. It's coming. Social Security, you elect it when the best time for you to elect it. And the thrift is there for you to do what you want until you're 70 and a half. So if you were to utilize all three of those as sources of income, picture what you've got. You've got a layer of the annuity. You've got now a layer of Social Security that's 85% taxable, I would say, for the bulk of people. And you got your TSP, which is 100% taxable. Now, if you layer all three of those together, you need to be very careful with your withholding, because the withholding from your base FERS annuity will never cover the other two.
Oh.
And then at the end of the year, you're not going to be a happy camper. Do you follow me?
So I would need, for the pension, I would need to increase. So what would I need to do?
Well, you have to look at all three, actually.
Okay.
So the lower you, what you did, I think you did properly. In retirement, when you're going to have the lower number of exemptions, that means there's going to be more withholding to maybe make up for, you may be entitled to a supplement. It's akin to Social Security, but it's 100%.
Right. I am entitled to a supplement.
Okay. That's going to be 100% taxable.
Okay.
100%. So that's where it differs from Social Security. And it's going to be added to your pension, right, Bob?
That's correct.
Okay. So now you got kind of two sources of income in there, and you might be saying to yourself, I don't know what that's going to do to me at the end of the year. And if you do take anything out of the thrift, but if you're taking the supplement, you might not want to, because you want that money to last a longer time. But
right.
You might.
No, I won't. I'm going to leave it alone.
Okay, good. That's what I thought. All righty. So I don't know. It's none of my business how you do your tax return. But if you do it with a computer-aided software package, or if you have somebody prepare it, or if you've got my admiration if you do it manually, pretend you're retired, and whatever system you use, whether it's manual, whether it's a software package, or whether it's a tax preparer, say, you know, what's my tax going to be in retirement? This is what it looks like for my annuity and plus the supplement. And then you'll know what the tax is, and then you can tell them what to withhold.
I see.
Otherwise, your call is good, because you're saying, I'm not so sure what this is going to do to me. Mm-hmm. But if you know what your tax is going to be, you can attack it from the reverse. Okay, this is how much I need withheld. This is how much I want you to withhold.
Okay.
And Bob, isn't it also true that you certainly can do withholding from, you know, when you're ultimately eligible for it, when you're drawing Social Security, you can adjust withholding from that. And you can even ask TSP. If you're taking an income stream from TSP, there's a form that you can fill out that's a lot like a W-4, which says withhold this amount for federal or state. And you know, the key to all of this, as you aptly put, Bob, is to know what your tax liability is going to be at the end of the year for all of these income streams that are coming in. You can get close to that. I mean, I guess you could technically have it all withheld from one of those sources, just as long as you meet your obligation at the end of the year and you don't owe money.
Yeah, the IRS could care less where it comes from. They just want it to come.
Yes, yes. I have one more quick question, and that's that my federal agency is giving me an opportunity to choose a flat 25% tax rate on the lump sum annual leave payment versus just my current rate. Now, it would seem to me that the 25% would be a better choice, because it's lower than my current tax rate. Is that, looking at it simply, is that a reasonable assumption?
I'm certainly not going to ask you what your tax rate is.
Well, I think it's around 28%. I'm a GS-14.
So. Okay, well, so you're going to be paying 28% now, and your annuity plus whatever else, the supplement, I'm not so sure you're going to be too much less than the demarcations are. You're 28, the next lower one is 25, and then the next lower one to that is 15. But remember, this is like walking upstairs. The first level of your income is very lightly taxed, and then when you get to a certain level, then it's taxed at a higher level. And currently you're now at a lofty level of 28, and I don't know if you live in a state with a state income tax, but when
Virginia.
You put...
Virginia.
Okay, so you're talking about roughly 5% there. So, don't forget them in your withholdings.
I see.
They have a certain break for retirees in Virginia, but it sounds like you're far from it. You have to be 70.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Again, the only thing I would add to that is that if you truly believe and you feel proof positive based on having run the numbers that as a retiree in that next year, since this leave check is coming to you in the next year, your income is going to be significantly lower.
Yes.
You know, possibly to the point where it may truly lower you to the 25% bracket, then maybe that is enough. But, I mean, without really being able to get your arms around what your taxable income is from all of these sources of income that you're going to be getting, it's kind of hard to determine. I mean, I agree with Bob 100%. I mean, it makes sense to withhold at your current rate. But if you really, truly are retired, and a lot of people who leave FERS, you know, particularly before they're eligible for Social Security, do continue to work at something gainful, and that adds to the tax burden as well. So, you know, it's not uncommon for many federal retirees, yours truly included, to leave federal service, get a replacement job, and wind up making more money that year as we did in any other year that we worked as a Fed.
Yeah, I don't have an intention to work.
one other thing I might want to add, when we talk about these tax brackets, that doesn't mean you pay an overall tax of 25 or 28. That's just your highest rate. So your overall rate might be less than 20. So if you have somewhat heavy withholding, you're probably looking at a refund. But when you're retired, you probably don't want big refunds. You just want to have a small refund.
That's
but
right.
You'd rather have the money to spend. I'm just going to make this comment. If you are married or happen to get married, that's more income on top of whatever you got. Not everybody's married. It's just a comment.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, Bob.
Okay. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye now. I understand we got another call, Bob. Good morning.
Okay, good.
No, we don't. Okay. So
We're talking about planning, if you're planning on retiring, one of the things that people start looking at as they get ready to retire, and maybe it's even too late because they've been paying for it for too long, is those folks who have optional life insurance coverage under the Federal Employees Group Life Insurance Plan. Optional life insurance coverage, particularly option B, which can be up to 5 times your salary, while being very inexpensive when you first start out, becomes more and more expensive. As you reach these tender ages of retirement of 55 or 60, it does what I call ugly doubling in cost. It gets more and more expensive. So one of the strategies that I suggest that people do, and they should really probably be doing this every 5 years, is taking a look at that insurance position and making certain that, number one, if they don't need large amounts of insurance, they start scaling back on this expensive option B coverage. Or if they still do, they think in terms of, you know, proving insurability and going out to a private company and perhaps getting it for less, a company that would take into account your lifestyle, your health, things that Fegley doesn't do. There's nothing that says you can't drop certain amounts of Fegley insurance at any time. But again, this is a decision that typically coalesces around retirement because people are looking at, those who are truly retiring, a drop in gross pay, and they're looking for ways to stabilize the drain, if you will, on the net pay. Backing off on some of this unneeded insurance, I mean, the kids have launched successfully, perhaps the mortgage has been paid down, the life insurance to fill the gap is not as necessary, so this is an opportunity to, you know, perhaps structure that back or reshape into something that's more affordable.
Okay, great. I'd also like to mention, we did a webinar last week on Social Security. Tammy was the lead. I was the moderator. And Robin was the technocrat behind it. And it's going to be on our website, NITPINC.com. And go to the federal employees section of it, and you can listen to it. It's going to be up for 90 days. It was a good webinar. We got 105 50-some-odd questions. And I showed them to you, I believe, Bob.
Mm-hmm.
And really nice slide presentation, very smooth. And I would urge anybody that is considering Social Security, listen to that. Let's come back to this. Were we at the mid-career level yet? I know we've really sliced and diced the pre-retirees.
Yeah, mid-career. I mean, it's always important to understand your position. You know, when are you going to be retired? What are your goals? I mean, I always suggest to people, even the mid-career folks, that you know, if for some reason you're not going to stay the course. If you're not going to stay in federal government, there are certain things that you definitely don't want to do. You don't want to close your TSP account if you leave. You don't want to pull out retirement contributions to FERS or CSRS or whatever, because you'll always be eligible for deferred benefits down the road. And if you pull out those contributions, then you've pretty much eliminated that prospect. But notwithstanding, if you continue to be a federal employee, the important thing that I always suggest to people is that you want to make certain you're putting away enough for tomorrow, but not inhibiting your ability to live now. I mean, it's always suggested if you're FERS, you want to contribute enough money into the TSP to at least get the match. I mean, the government gives you 1% automatically. You get a dollar-for-dollar match on your first 3%. 50 cents on the dollar for the next 2%. So if you're doing a 5% contribution, you're getting 5% free money from the government before you even invest. So you always want to do that, and you do more as you can afford to do so. But you don't want to do so much that it actually inhibits or dampens your ability to enjoy life now. Life is a long time. Nothing's certain. Put away enough, but do it in balance. So I always suggest to people, strike the appropriate balance, increase where you can. Make sure you understand what your annuity value is going to be. There are many ballpark calculators out there. You can always figure out what FERS or CSRS is going to be. For FERS folks, generally speaking, that's going to be about 30 to 33% of what your income is. Social Security, if you're a relatively high income earner, that might replace 25 to 30% of income, and then you get a lot of it from the rest of it from TSP. Real question is what's your lifestyle going to be? What are your retirement planning goals? What do you expect to do as a retiree? And the closer you can get to attaching a financial figure to the cost of that lifestyle, the better off you're going to be. Kind of tough to do it mid-career, but it's never too early to begin thinking about it.
Okay. Beginning career, what should they be doing? Roth TSP.
Definitely. Well, I would tell you this much. Always contribute enough into TSP to get the match. And interesting, you say Roth TSP. If somebody was contributing 5% of income and it was all going to a Roth, and you're the one that took me to school on this, obviously the government's going to match, but they're only going to match on the tax-deferred side because there's no matching Roth. Isn't that correct?
That's true.
Do that for sure. Always recognize that once you've got 5 years of federal service, you're technically vested in FERS. Now, what does that mean? You know, if I'm vested in FERS, I've got 5 years, and let's just say I'm 28, 29 years old, and I decide to leave the federal government. Well, if you leave federal government, just because you're vested in the annuity program doesn't mean you're going to get anything right away. You have to reach a certain number of years in FERS as well as reach a certain age. Let's say you never came back to work for the government, but you had 5 years as a federal employee that were covered by FERS. What the Office of Personnel Management would allow you to do, assuming you live long enough, I guess you got to feel lucky, you got to make it to age 62. At 62, you could apply for a deferred retirement annuity benefit at OPM. And they would go back and they would look at your service history and say, well, you earned this much money. This was your high three average salary. You worked for 5 years. It's going to be worth a small annuity amount. But it's probably going to be an annuity amount that was equivalent to what you put into FERS on a biweekly basis. I mean, for older employees, it's a little bit less than 1%. For the newer folks coming on board, it's about 3.2%. But that's going to give you an annuity for the rest of your life. The only thing you have to do is live. You're vested within 5 years. You're vested in your TSP. You have your own funds immediately, the government matching funds within 3 years. If you ever left federal government, keep that TSP account open because you can always roll money into it from 401k, 403b plans, from other employers. You still have a G fund, which, to my knowledge, has always been doing better than money market and CDs these days. It's doing pretty well. So, again, it sounds like I'm talking about if you ever decide to leave. The important thing is understand what you're contributing to. Understand the value of these benefits. Position yourself to stay the course as a federal employee and continue to increase TSP. Always be aware of what your annuity value is going to be. Make sure you have enough life insurance along the way. Just be conscious of the value of these benefit packages. The other things we haven't really been talking about is the portability of these benefits if you manage to stay the course and actually retire. You can take your health insurance with you as long as you've been covered for at least 5 years immediately prior to retirement. Same thing for life insurance. And a lot of benefits are portable without even a five-year rule, such as dental and vision coverage. All of these benefits, as an employee, the premiums that you pay for health insurance, the premiums you pay for dental and vision, those are paid on a pre-tax basis. So there are lots of things that you need to understand the value of as an employee. But by and large, the important thing is financial literacy from the get-go. When you're a brand-new employee, understand the value of what it is you're contributing to, when you technically hit a vesting threshold, what that means, and what it can mean for you down the road if you stay the course and remain a federal employee for a career.
Okay. A lot of things considered. Now, beginning career of folks, this gets outside of probably both our wheelhouses, but beginning career, they have a whole, if you will, road of opportunities ahead of them. So they could go to agency A, like it, but feel that they might rather go to agency B. So Mike Hawes used to have a term for that with the number of opportunities that they have. Is it still easy to transfer between agencies, Bob, or is it less easy now?
I think, to my knowledge, it's probably easier because so much of it's electronic, Bob. I mean, even Standard Forms 50, these are the notifications of personal action when somebody resigns or when somebody is transferred from one agency to another. I mean, the losing and the gaining agencies probably share a lot of this information electronically. Even official personnel files are now electronically housed, and just about all of the new personnel actions are being done electronically. There's still some scanning in of old data, but the newer folks are probably finding it easier. Everything can pretty much be, including leave records. The ability to transfer from one organization to another should be facilitated by technology. I would think it's easier. It used to be that, you know, it took sometimes 90 days to get an official personnel folder to flow from the losing organization, the organization from which the person is transferring, to the gaining organization where they're going to wind up. Technology has certainly helped to improve that. I wouldn't say that there's absolutely a unified database between federal organizations, but it's gotten better, and I think there's people are up and running. Most important thing for an employee to do when they go from one organization to another is bring a copy of their final pay stub, things that would reference annual sick leave balances. I mean, that basically gets them a jump on any paperwork that may take a little bit longer to flow, albeit electronically or through the mail.
Okay, that's good. And the opportunities as well, schooling, classes, ability to be, I guess, creative to an extent. Probably can't be too creative because you haven't earned your stripes yet. But if I had the same thought process back when I graduated from school, I didn't know that. I thought you went one place and you stayed one place for the rest of your life, and I couldn't find a place I wanted to stay.
Yeah, and I think to some extent it depends on what your occupational objective is, too. I mean, there are many, many organizations that, if I was a human resources specialist, I could pretty much work anywhere. Now, if that's what I studied, human resources management. Some particular occupations of scientific nature, might be an organization like NASA or NIH. I mean, you may be relegated to the organizations that have those occupations. But, again, there's nothing that necessarily says you have to stay in the government your entire career, which is why I say if you ever did leave the government and you are vested in your benefits, you can ultimately come back and start your career again. your service computation date for eligibility to retire would be interrupted somewhat. If I worked 5 years and started working, say, in 1995 on January 1st, and then I left for 10, well, when I come back, then my service computation date is not going to be 1995 anymore. It's going to be 2005 or something. It's basically, they're not going to give me credit for the time that I was away, but I basically start in where I left off. I can still achieve an ability to retire. When I leave federal service, any unused sick leave that I haven't used will stay out there. It hangs out there in perpetuity and would come back to me as a federal employee if ever I came back to federal service. It used to be that it was gone in 3 years. That no longer is the case. So you can explore lots of different options, and as long as you have the opportunity to come back to another federal appointment, everything else pretty much takes up from where it left off, which is why it's important to leave TSP open, why it's important not to withdraw indiscriminately those contributions that are automatically pulled from your paycheck every 2 weeks to pay into what's called FERS. It's technically going into what's called the Civil Service Retirement Disability Fund, but it's your share of what's going to produce this FERS annuity down the road. The government's going to match that. They're going to match your TSP. They match Social Security. So it's portability is very important, and the ability to come back and go in and out of government, depending upon, you know, what job opportunities are, you could be doing a lot of things. So just make certain that you leave certain things intact whenever you leave, so when you come back, they can be there for you.
Okay, Bob, I'm getting the 1 minute sign. One thing I would like to mention, beginning and mid-career folks, become financially literate. Listen to the show and you'll become financially literate, and we'll certainly do a webinar or two on it. Really important to do at the beginning. Bob, final comments before we get cut off?
At this point in time, I would just say, you know, be smart. Be smart about investment. Understand your tax position, just like you've been saying all along, Bob. Understand the value of benefits. It's always important to know what it is you're contributing to and what it's going to give you in return. Federal careers are wonderful to have. From my own standpoint, I can't tell you how.
Okay, we're gonna have no more career here, Bob.
Sorry about that.
Thanks for being on the show. See you next time you're in D.C. Bye bye, and please listen next week. Mike Causey will be on with us. Bye bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.
Legal mistakes can be costly, whether it's a business contract or dispute, a family situation or property. Power of Attorney covers all that and more. This Saturday at 10 a.m., join the attorneys from Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman and learn the latest legal developments affecting businesses and individuals. Power of Attorney is sponsored by Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman, a full-service law firm taking pride in working together with our clients, fully invested in their success. Visit us on the web at ofplaw.com.
This is Mark Amtower. If you're looking for cost-effective and efficient methods for marketing your products or services to the government or to other government contractors, look to LinkedIn. There are over 400,000 members in the D.C. area and more than 92 million nationwide, but only a small percentage actually use it well. I can show you how to leverage LinkedIn in ways that support your marketing, sales, and business development efforts. I do this for large and small companies, and I can do it for you. Drop me a line at mark@federaldirect.net.
Acquisition and Industry Thursday on Federal News Radio. At 9, listen for the Coalition for Government Procurements Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron, where procurement policy meets process. At 11, Bloomberg Government hosts Capital Impact, focusing on the business implications of government actions. And hear from companies themselves on policy, regulations, and trends on Industry Chatter with Francis Rose, Thursdays at 4. Acquisition and Industry Thursday on 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.